Hey, everybody, welcome to the Daily Objective. And today we're going to be talking about something near and dear to everybody at the Ayn Rand Center, UK, the Prime Minister of England, UK, London, something. Anyway, people always say if you want to know about British politics, get an American and a Greek. And that's exactly what we've done here for you today. Now, don't worry, we've got somebody here who knows a lot more about this than I do. And please welcome him. He is the myth, the Greek myth himself, Nikos Sotirakopoulos.
Thank you. So how do they say it? We watch the speech so that you don't have to, dear viewers. So this was the speech by the Prime Minister in the Tory conference. So the setting matters because when they are in their conference, usually political leaders tend to show more of an ideological, they give more of an ideological aura in their speech. They have to throw some red meat to their audience. So we have a clear plan and details on the speech. But before we start, while I was reading the speech, there was a voice playing in my head. And it took me some time to figure out what that speech reminds me. And it reminds me a scene from Atlas Shrugged, part 3. So mega spoiler alert. If you haven't read Atlas Shrugged, now it's time to pause. John Gall has been captured, but of course the central planners claim that he's their friend and that they have a magical plan to save the economy. So they have this reception, the equivalent, let's say, of a conference. And the central leader in charge, Wesley Mouch, declares, "The John Gall plan will reconcile all conflicts. It will protect the property of the rich and give a greater share to the poor. It will cut down the burden of your taxes and provide you with more government benefits. It will lower prices and raise wages. It will give more freedom to the individual and strengthen the bonds of collective obligations. It will combine the efficiency of free enterprise with the generosity of planned economy." So this is, let's say, the caricature. This is the actual talk from Atlas Shrugged. Obviously, Ayn Rand tries to make a caricature of the principle-less politician who just throws things and doesn't have an idea of a principle. And this is what Boris Johnson's talk reminded me of. Now, let's go to the talk itself. And so that we are fair, Boris begins with some of the achievements of his government or of the areas where his government has done better than other governments. And he says, "We are now post-lockdown, one of the most open societies in Europe and in the world, if not the most open in terms of COVID restrictions." This is true. You can basically live your life in the UK without noticing that there is still a pandemic happening in terms of things. So there's almost no restriction. There are some still restrictions in traveling, but living in the UK, there's basically no restriction. He also mentions the very successful vaccine rollout, again, for the standards of a government, that indeed they did well. And again, because he is in a Tory conference, he's in a Conservative Party conference, at some point he says, "Let us be clear that there is a huge philosophical difference between us and Labour." And basically, he says that we believe in leveling up, in bringing the poor up, whereas Labour believes in bringing the poor down. And also, when it comes to the vaccine, he starts by, again, saying it's not the governments that brought the vaccine. It's capitalism that brought you the vaccine, of course, helped by government research and all that stuff. So the left today is focusing on this, that Boris Johnson revealed his face as a market radical. So shall I pause here, Raka, or shall I go to the bad things? Because my praise stops somewhere here.
That's a pretty good start. Real quick, we've got Sammy's board again with 99 pence and a unicorn. Thank you for that. And the Shadow Blade with 5 pounds says, "Sorry for missing your talk last night, Nikos. I feel I'll just as well as I was close to the Carriage Works Theater and decided to go home just in case." Well, Shadow Blade, Nikos might forgive you, but I never will. Don't you ever miss his talk again. And thank you for the super chat.
Well, okay. I don't want to brag, but even if you showed up, No, I think there was one or two empty seats, so you might would be able to fit. But it was a great event. Thanks for those of you who... And we're going to catch up another point at another... I didn't know we had friends in Leeds, so... But thank you very much even for considering to come. Okay.
Okay.
Enough with praising Bozo, so now let's go to the things that, in my view, makes zero sense. So he starts with the obligatory salute to the state religion of the UK, which is, of course, the national healthcare system, the NHS. He says some morbid stuff, that he was in ICU, in intensive care unit, and he was seeing something like people digging, and he thought it's his grave, but the brave nurses saved him, and turns out it wasn't a grave, it was a new hospital rising. So there was a lot of kits in his talk, but anyway. So then he says, then, and I want to focus on some stuff that I think show a real economic illiteracy. And again, from someone who is supposedly a classical liberal, and from someone who supposedly has been around in banquets and events of free market think tanks and all that stuff, he should know better. So listen to this. We are not going back to the same old broken model with low wages, low growth, low skills, and low productivity. All of it enabled and assisted by uncontrolled immigration. So even in the minds of a conservative, how is low productivity? I mean, low wages, okay, I kind of understand it, but if you claim that you understand freedom, how does productivity and immigration relate to? So what's so let's say, again, let's try to steal money. Why are conservatives so obsessed with these things that actually immigration is bad even for the economy and even in terms of the productivity of the business itself? So what do they have in mind with that?
You're asking me?
Yes.
Well, that seems to be what's important to the voters. So they find a way to connect it. I mean, you couldn't connect immigration to anything if that was your job, basically, to pander to these voters. Look anyway. At the way I answered your question with literally nothing happening in here. That's their job to do full time. Answer a question as though they've thought about it before.
Okay. But this was like completely out of the blue. So I was reading and low wages, low growth, low skills. Okay, he's probably going to say something, I don't know, the role of the state. And then it's like enabled and assisted by uncontrolled immigration. Again, economy 101. A business needs someone, they get someone who is clearly productive because otherwise they wouldn't get him. Or they say, well, but because they are poor, sorry, because they're cheap, the business hasn't got the incentive to invest in, let's say, machinery. Again, this makes no sense. If machinery is going to be more productive to the business than, let's say, five immigrants, they're going to get the machine. If they get five immigrants, it means that the five immigrants are more productive than the one machine. So it takes a central planner, the mindset of a central planner, to say, I judge and I claim that immigration is bad for productivity. And again, this is the mindset of Boris Johnson, and this is the mindset of modern conservative. And it's something even worse coming then. So he has to say something bad about labor every now and then. So he talks about they're going to be tough with policing. Again, law and order stuff. And he says, and look at our opponents. What does labor want to do? They want to decriminalize hard drugs. First of all, I haven't heard labor saying that. I wish they did. So again, you have someone who is supposedly a polymath, a bright mind, educated. And this is like free economics 101. You decriminalize drugs, you have less crime. Somehow in this minds, in this man's mind, by decriminalizing the drugs, you're going to get more crime. Because notice, he doesn't mention crime when it comes to, let's say, broken communities. He doesn't say, if we decriminalize drugs, more people, more families will be broken. He says, no, as part of law and order, we reject these crazy leftists who say decriminalize drugs. So again, my sympathy to the free market think tanks who have spent, I don't know, probably hundreds of thousands to events with Tory party influencers, ministers, and the Tory prime minister does not understand that decriminalizing drugs is not going to lead to more crime.
I mean, yeah, this is what we're dealing with. So is he trying to like pander to the more left-leaning people with the immigration point, saying like this has been great that we've had unrestricted immigration? Or was he saying to the conservatives, like, look what we were able to accomplish with open borders. Imagine what we could accomplish with closed borders. Or do you know what point he was trying to make with regards to that?
I think he was trying to say the opposite. He was trying to say that because here's again the central plan. He said, we want immigrants, but we want the skilled ones. Hmm. Again, who is we? The only person who can decide who is productive and who is good for one's business is the person running that business. I might not want, quote, skilled immigrants. I might have fields, and I just need someone who has experience in fields. So what does it mean, quote, skilled? But again, this is the mindset of a central planner, or to say this in different words, of a right-wing central planner.
And these politicians represent us, the voters. Obviously, you and I disagree with how they're doing things, but we are a true minority. And the vast majority of voters and people who pay attention to politics in the Western world, they see the government as here to engineer, as here to design society in some way or another. So the question of immigration should relate to what do we like, what benefits us to accept, you know, a bunch of unskilled labor? No, maybe not, because that would compete with our unskilled laborers. But, you know, smart immigrants, maybe. Yeah, maybe we should let them in. But then the new right, the sort of the populist right, one up, like takes it a step higher and says, well, no, maybe smart immigrants from Asia and India are not that good, because what do they do anyway? They go to Silicon Valley and manipulate our society with their leftism. So maybe we need to actually start doing away with Silicon Valley and high skilled industry anyway. Maybe we need to get back to factory life and have basically, you know, mechanical labor be the sort of norm. And they think that's possible. They think, I mean, obviously I'm taking liberties with what it is that the right wingers say, but that they're trying to tame the development of technology and sort of glamorizing, romanticizing the days of everyone working in a factory. They actually think it's possible that you can just take us, 40 years backwards in time and just hold it there. Like we'll just be able, the divine right of stagnation, they actually believe is possible. Of course, that's not possible at all in your personal life. If you're not actively eating, you know, eating, working, sustaining yourself, you're moving towards death. You also can't stagnate economically. Either you're growing and taking things to the next level, or you're moving back towards the cave.
And here's the part where it's really reminded me that Wesley Mouts quote. So he says, Boris says, by sorting out our energy supply, more wind, more nuclear, becoming less dependent on hydrocarbons from abroad, by putting in blah, 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 we will hold costs down and save you money. So basically what's been happening in the UK is that energy prices are going up rapidly. And what is Boris saying? He's saying that by relying to unreliable sources and the most expensive source, though reliable, which is nuclear, prices are going to go down. How? Somehow. In the same way that Wesley Mouts is bullshitting the citizens that that somehow he will protect the property of the rich and give a greater share to the poor. So, and Boris has to play this balance in when it comes to environmental policy. So he criticized activists who glue themselves. He said, and they stop traffic. He said they belong to prison. But then he rushed to say that we are committing to net zero by 2050. So Boris Johnson's claim is that, look, we share the values and the sentiments, let's say, with environmentalists, but we don't agree, number one, with their methods, and number two, with their timescale. We don't believe net zero can be brought in 15 years, but we believe it can be brought in 30 years. So this is the battle of ideas in the British society, basically. The means and the timescale. The ends are obviously, there's consensus.
It's depressing. I mean, politics are depressing if you value liberty, if you value individual rights, if you someday see the government defend the rights of the individual and enable capitalism to exist. then it's very depressing to see the state of politics, which again represents the voters. It represents what people are voting for and what they would like to see. These politicians are not ideologues. They're all of them. I think all of them are here to, they're giving the voters what the voters asked for. And I know somebody's going to say, oh no, the politicians don't listen to us anymore. They don't listen to us. They absolutely do listen to us. They're, you might not feel like they're listening to you because the particular politicians you're looking at, they made promises and accepted campaign donations from a different lobby. But what's your answer to that? Is your answer laissez-faire capitalism? Of course not. In most cases, the answer is no, they should listen to we the people, right? The populist, the popular lobby, the average Joe, Joe Sixpack, Middle America or Middle England, you know, where's Sargon from? Swindon, you know, is that like middle of nowhere? Is that where the working no class idea. Sits around on their porch and dreams of when the factories were intact? I mean, this is people's answer to the corruption of the lobby system. No, they need to be listening to we the people. And how does that look in practice? It is just another lobby. And Bernie Sanders speaks for the people with his type of lobby activism. And Donald Trump and Boris Johnson, they speak for we the people in a different way. You know, but the right wing populism says we'll provide you with a job. The sort of left-wing one says we'll provide you with welfare, whether or not you have a job. And this is supposed to be the battle of ideas. This is supposed to be uplifting. This is supposed to be giving me hope that there's any hope in politics. I think not.
Don't worry, it gets worse. So for those of you who are watching the podcast, the episodes, we've said many, many times, there is one area that a conservative today, without principles, without clear differences from the left in the fundamentals, there is one area where they can shine. What area is that? Of course, the culture wars. So, of course, Boris has to throw some red meat there because there were many young culture warrior conservatives, you know, the types of people who were kind of half-heartedly complaining at some point with the lockdown. But then, of course, they are in the conference and they're clapping. So he has to throw some meat to them. Well done, by the way, to these people. Be proud for your party. So he talked about the hetero war. He talked about the woke. He says we really are at risk of a kind of know-nothing cancel culture, know-nothing iconoclasm. And so we conservatives will defend our history and our cultural inheritance, not because we are proud of everything, but because trying to edit it now is as dishonest as a celebrity trying furtively to change his entry in Wikipedia. To be honest, I've read this 3 or 4 times. I still don't get it. If the entry in Wikipedia is false, you should change it. So he says we're not proud about everything. So again, it's this shallowness of the culture wars. You see, basically, you can say nothing and throw these buzzwords, cancel culture, woke. Earlier, he said something about Churchill. By the way, he's right on that, trying to quote cancel Churchill is ridiculous. But this is the shallowness of the culture wars. Throw some red meat and everything goes. Now the basis is, they got their dose of outrage.
Yeah, I mean, if the culture warriors were smart, they would want to privatize education so that nobody's arguing about what the kids are being taught in school. Every parent can decide where to send their kids to school. If they were smart, they would want capitalism. But no, instead, they're trying to seize the means of production on behalf of their own cultural attitude. So if they're more on the conservative side, they want to change the public schools to teach more or less leftist stuff. And we're seeing people like Charlie Kirk say, yeah, like double down on the culture war. Say you want public schools to teach the Bible as well, and maybe even alternative views of evolution, like creationism. So, yeah, please count me out of that culture war. And of course, increasingly, we're seeing them wanting to nationalize or heavily regulate and break up and invoke antitrust towards Silicon Valley companies. So, I mean, Yeah, you want a culture war? Fine, fight a culture war. Fight for privatizing and then fight the battles that actually matter. Don't try to accuse these don't try to accuse the whole world of being committed communists against you. You know, last time we did an episode, I spoke about how I'm dealing with reprimanding and quote censorship from big tech companies. I actually got in touch with someone at YouTube. This is like amazing. Like, it's like you finally get to the other side, the behind the curtain of the Wizard of Oz, and the guy's super polite, like, hey, thanks for reaching us, you know, really sorry you're going through that, okay, I'll pass this along to the internal team. And then like the next day, all right, we looked into it, you know, you're good, here's your channel back, blah blah blah, like. And then he wants me to leave him a review, you know, like 1 out of 5 stars, 1 to 10 stars. These are the committed communists at big tech, right? They want you to leave them a Yelp review after all that. I mean, there's a lot happening in Silicon Valley. There's a lot happening in any company. I mean, just between me and Nikos, there's a world of difference at times. So people actually think that like the biggest sector of the economy right now is a monolith, just one big arm of communist China. I don't buy it. Anyway,
China is not communist, so I would start.
Right. Don't tell Boris, and I don't really know much about Boris. Don't tell Republicans.
So this was Boris's talk. Now, any other episode would stop there, but not the Daily Objective. So do you remember that minister who took over the health ministry or the equivalent? Sajid Javid, who is supposedly Iranian, and everyone was up in arms, and we did a whole episode why this guy is not Iranian, and by the way, myths about Ayn Rand that everyone brought to surface when he became minister. So I wanted to read also I went and read his speech, because, okay, let's see what the Randian said. So here is what the Randian, right, the guy whose Ayn Rand is his idol, according to the left, this is what he said. There are few higher callings than to care for another person. Some of you, and then he says, what you might not know about my time as a student back in Exeter is that every Saturday I would visit a care home as a volunteer to keep the residents company and all that stuff. Now, why is he saying this? Why is he going out of the way to say this? Because what he said earlier is, some of you know that I got up to some antics as a student. I got thrown out of a party conference for campaigning against something which was an environmental stuff. I was a cool kid. So he's saying, look, my, let's say, objectivist or more radical past, come on, that was a cool kid stuff. I find this pathetic. I find it way more genuine to say, look, I was a Stalinist. I did thuggish things. This is why I was a Stalinist. This is why I changed my mind. This, you know, it's just a silly kid. I find this really, really weird. And again, how does he counteract it? But I also went to, you know, I went to help other people because nothing is better than that. So forget about these crazy things I said about the founding and all that stuff. So I don't know. I find it a bit sad. I mean, it's good if you went and helped there, if it was meaningful. Maybe some people were suffering unjustly. You helped. Good for you. But the context in which he puts it is quite.
Yeah.
God and again, help us that's too. Supposedly the ideologue. That's like the Randian in this government. Okay.
All right. Jonathan Honig with $1.99. Thank you for that. Marilyn with $10 says number one fan. I like Marilyn. We're big fans of hers here. And our good friend Hugh James, not sure at this point if he's a parody or not, in the regular chat room, not where the high status upper class people like Marilyn go to super chat. This is where the moochers of society post their free piece. Hugh James says it's subversive. What did he say? Like they're it's deception. Talking about YouTube, it's deception, subversive nature. It's not clear, and it's never clear if he's joking or not. But this is actually how people see like the other, you know, Silicon Valley today, Jews yesterday, Jews probably tomorrow. You can take any other ism, anytime that a group of people are being scapegoated, remove that particular group of people and replace it with Silicon Valley, big tech, and just you have this blanket statement about all of them. They're all evil. They're all one thing. They have one hive mind, and this is the way people look at them. It's, I mean, there's a reason we're seeing Republicans, the new right, increasingly show like sympathy to the Taliban, being like, you know, maybe the Taliban are, maybe we have more in common with them than we thought. There's a reason for that. The mentality that overtakes most of the Middle East, where they still hold on to medieval views of Jews and, you know, basically Western man as being deceptive and constantly trying to trick them. This is how people basically are operating. The more tribal we get, the less individualistic we get, the more we're going to see this kind of stupidity. And I'm very not happy about it. Now, do you have...
Sorry, you mentioned tribal, so I have to, but yeah, go on.
Now, get ready for this. Get out your dictionary and your best thinking hat, because we got a super chat from Phil with £5. He says, Johnson is that psychiatric dichotomy, the altruistic narcissist, also known as the psychopath specializing in shallow effect.
So, Phil, my suggested my original suggested title, which was not declined, but the powers to be chose another one. My original title was two titles suggested: The Nothingness of Boris Johnson's, or Boris Speaks and Says Nothing. Which so we are. I don't know about the definitions of the thing you said, but I think we agree that there's not much there.
I mean, I look at most politicians as like they're narcissistic. I think you have to have something wrong with you to be a politician in today's world, unless you're just exceptionally different from most of them. And altruism is like the underlying presumption, right? Like whatever you're doing, you're not doing for yourself, you're doing for the people, and whatever policy you enact, it's to help the downtrodden and the people who need help the most. You know, like what did Romney say? I'm not concerned about the very rich or about the very poor. They've got their welfare. You know, it's the middle class. It's always the working class, the middle class, or it's the very poor. It's never about justice. It's never about, I want everyone who earns something to keep it. It could never.
But you know what's fascinating about that? Mm-hmm. For example, Stalin, I'm reading a super long biography. Stalin was 100% an altruist. Most people don't get it. People think he was power hungry. No, Stalin actually had serious health problems because he was overworking. Stalin died, quote, poor. Stalin sacrificed his son in the war with Germany. So the Germans told him, do you want to exchange your son with generals? Although I haven't reached that point, but that's, I think it's almost agreed historically that it happened. Stalin said no. So Stalin was an altruist. And at the same time, one of the biggest mass murderers in history. So people think that the altruism in politics is like a facade, and behind it, it's people who want personal gain. Stalin was 100% serious that it wasn't about himself. When he did the mass terror, it was very possible that he would fall victim of it. But it was like, yeah, this is what the revolutionary process requires. And yeah, if I'm next to be shot, that's what happened. So some of them are really altruist. I don't think that Boris has reached that level of being obsessed with an idea that he's going to sacrifice everything. Is more like the narcissist / altruist thing sounds, I think Phil is onto something, although again, I don't like psychology and don't know these terms.
And people are complex. So like a dictator could from 8 to 10 p.m. be having orgies with peasants, like the dictator of China, Mao, but also firmly believe that what he's doing benefits the people and, you know, all these millions for the greater good. So, you know, Stalin living in a mansion, presumably surrounded by servants and anything he wants. He's like, on one hand, he has an ego, as does every living being, but at the same time, feeling like I need to be doing the right thing and bringing prosperity to the people, or bringing whatever it is that I'm trying to bring. So people are complex. You know, it's hard enough to even understand myself. I'm not going to try to step into the mind of a monster. But I mean, it doesn't surprise me that he was that committed to what he thought was going to benefit the proletariat, because if what he really wanted was money and women, He can just grab a few billion and go to an island somewhere. You know, who needs to preside over all this misery for so long?
In his death's birthday or in his actual birthday in February or in March, depending on which we do, we can have a mega episode on Stalin if people are interested, because it's in some ways it verifies many of the things that Rand said about evil, and it completely obliterates many of the bromides that people think when they think of a big dictator. But anyway,
it's going to be a great episode if we do that. I think the fact that he gets such a pass, that the communists get such a pass, I think speaks of the altruism that's still prevalent. Robert with the sorry just got here. And as a Yankee, I've no idea what a modern Tory is nor why they're conferencing. Oh, well, here's some dirty American money. Thank you, Robert. And we got another super chat from Marilyn with $2. She says there's a rumor that Khrushchev strangled Stalin. Well, Nikos, have you heard
so
this?
So what actually happened? First of all, you need to understand something. Anyone who was around in highest echelons in the 50s means that in the 30s, in the period of terror, they were the ones that were throwing under the bus their colleagues, or they're giving many quotas of people to be executed. So anyone who was around Stalin in the 50s was a survivor of the worst kind. And Khrushchev was amongst them. However, I think it's very clear what happened. Stalin died and was actually dying, and everyone was so afraid that they basically let him die. So interestingly, the film The Death of Stalin, although in a caricature form, captures some of the basics. So I don't believe that Khrushchev actually killed him. However, what I do know is that Khrushchev was already, obviously, completely disillusioned with Stalin. So Khrushchev's son at some point said, when Stalin died, my father came back home. And like Khrushchev's son was crying, and his father was Khrushchev, the person who became president, he was like cold. And his son was in such a shock, like, how can you not be like in peril? Stalin died. And Khrushchev told him something like, well, I know more than you do, or something like that. So Khrushchev is also an interesting persona, but in a different way. Khrushchev was more like the outlandish, the more like noisy, the guy who... Stalin was way, way deeper, though, in a dark way than Khrushchev. And that's why Khrushchev was the only leader of Soviet Union who lost his job, basically, who did not lose his position because of death.
Have you thought of doing like a series on like, you know, a former communist or an on the historicism? Does a series?
I don't think there would be much interest in that.
You don't think people put in a anti-communist that used to be one and knows a lot about him?
We'll see,
he says. All right, just a pile of the tape you need to do about the thing that you enjoy. Anyway, there's a you know what you then my as when people commenting are moochers, obviously a joke. We appreciate all the comments.
By the way, Raka, we are losing you when you go from one mic to the other or something. So one of the mics is not working well, or is it just me?
Bugging out and acting weird.
Now it's better.
Can you hear me? Give me a thumbs up if you can hear my voice. Starting with AM UK and with Robert and Amy at 10 p.m. UK time. Right now, we're going to say thank you for joining us. Like to see Nikos' new series, and we'll be back here.
I can't hear much, so I hope I haven't committed to anything, because I'm losing. It's all like right. That episode of Friends where Chandler falls asleep and he finds out he has a job in Tulsa. Anyway, bye, everyone.